welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm a journalist on health, food, and the environment, and I'm here with you every week on the Progressive Radio Network at 10 a.m. Wednesdays Eastern Time to talk about all of the things that affect our personal health from our society and our total health environment. For many years, I was a reporter on various self-help and self-care approaches that I still champion, eating right, getting exercise, managing stress, all those good things that we as individuals can do to protect and promote our health. But as I covered these topics over many years, I began to see that there's much more that we're doing as a society that impacts our health and our well-being and the well-being of our friends, our family, our communities, our society, and indeed planet Earth, that can't just necessarily be touched by our personal health behaviors or even our consumer choices. And that's why over about 7 years ago, I began covering a range of different social vectors and policy opportunities and actions that would help us protect our health and habitat. And that's what we do every week here on Connect the Dots. We discuss different vectors, different opportunities, and different facets of all of the things that come together and influence our health, the health of our ecology, the health of our society. And every week I have authors and experts and others, and I also cover all of these topics in my blogs on Alternet, EcoWatch, and the Huffington Post. This week, we are actually launching what we had intended to kind of do last week, but we had some technical problems. But we will be covering this topic for the rest of this month, as well as into next month. And that is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. I'm often surprised at how little people know about this, and there's a lot of activism going on this month and an important opportunities to intervene, and one of the things that I always champion is intervening early. It's better to stop a problem before it happens than to have to play catch-up afterward, and all too often we do the latter, and this show is all about doing the former. So this begins several weeks of programming on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We're going to learn all about it, different facets of how it is at risk to affect us, our health and environment, and indeed even our social order in certain ways. And so to launch that, as our guest on today's show, I'm delighted to welcome Stan Sorcher. He's been writing extensively on this topic in his daily life. He is labor representative at the Society for Professional Engineering Employees in Aerospace. The acronym for that is SPEA. This is a union representing scientists, engineers, pilots, technical and professional employees in the aerospace industry. So Stan is going to be coming at this in part from that professional background and in part from his longstanding work in community with the Washington Fair Trade Coalition and other organizations. He's also, like me, a contributor to the Huffington Post. And just as on this program, I regularly cover fracking and other forms of energy toxic exposures and economic impacts, as well as food policy and other things. We all come at these bigger picture issues through the lens of the places where we get educated to them. And so I'm really thrilled and delighted to have Stan's perspective on something that he has really studied in depth and written on extensively to share with us today on our show. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Stan Sorcher.
Thanks, Allison. It's good talking to you.
So can you begin with just a basic primer? Trans-Pacific Partnership is TPP. That's how we can refer to it. And this is a series of free trade agreements that the United States is currently pushing to participate in along with a whole group of other nations. First of all, there's a number of problems that people have identified with this. One of it is that the provisions are not really well known. So in effect, there's been an effort to so-called fast-track this so that many of the details are kind of glossed over, and as such, the implications are glossed over. Can you give our listeners an orientation and to the TPP and a little background on it?
Sure. I liked your introduction that you came from this from from perspective that was important to you in healthcare, and I come to it from a perspective that's important to me from job security and economic development. The fact is that these trade agreements do affect almost every aspect of our lives. And part of the confusion that people have, I think, is that they hear trade agreements and they think about trade, and then it's hard, that's sort of an obstacle to connecting it to their daily lives. I live in Seattle, and an ambassador from the European Union came here to promote the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and he used a great expression that connected a lot of dots for me. He said, the way business looks at these agreements will determine how life is organized in 2050. So for a generation or two generations, these trade agreements are going to set the conditions for how we organize life in terms of, you mentioned food security and fracking, access to medicines, the things that we would normally do politically to manage the way, the way our lives are organized. The trade agreements will set the terms at a global level for what kind of policies we can follow and what priorities we'll set, and how rights and privileges are defined. So I like to think of the Constitution of the United States, right? When we wrote the Constitution in 1789, we were really struggling with that question of how life was going to be organized. And the Constitution expressed our values as a people, mm-hmm. and gave moral authority to the government, and set up courts and enforcement of powers and rights and privileges. The Bill of Rights determined, again, expressed those moral values. And from then on, you know, for generations, for centuries, that's how life was organized. That's sort of the role that these trade agreements will play. There are global financial institutions. We think of the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. These global institutions become the mechanism for enforcing the rules that are set in the trade agreements. And again, the trade agreements are going to say who has rights, whose rights have priority, what social values we're going to express, and how we're going to enforce them. So the trade agreements really do touch on they touch on our lives in ways that are much broader than you would normally think just here in trade agreements.
Mm-hmm. That's really important. I think, that's a really excellent way of framing that. I think the other thing that confuses people is, on the one hand, if they hear trade agreement, as you point out, they don't feel that it has anything to do with them, with us, with our lives. On the other hand, if we do hear that phrase, we might quite often feel like we have nothing to do about it, or we have no say in the matter. This is being decided by big entities, and, you know, we're kind of just all going to sort of have to trundle along, sort of thing. But there are entree points for making one's own values and wishes known, because, as you stated, this is going to define the framework for our values, our social values, who has priority, who has latitude, who has protection across a range of vectors for some time to come. So right now is really the entree point, you know, or the time when we can have a say, and when we would do well to have a say, when we need to have a say. So can you just give a little bit of a why we want to do this, a few examples of that? Why would we want to take this off of the list of the too many things that we have time for and put it on the list of something we want to do something about?
Sure. You mentioned the example of fracking, which I think is a good illustration of this. Mm-hmm. Quebec has a moratorium on fracking. There was a Canadian oil company that wanted to frack underneath the St. Lawrence Seaway, their principal waterway. And the provincial government in Quebec said, well, maybe we should think about this and see what consequences fracking might have on the St. Lawrence Seaway. Mm-hmm. But in the Canadian political process, there's a way to do this, right? The provincial government has agencies that study this, and there's a political process for setting up the moratorium. The Canadian oil company had no recourse to prevent this other than their normal participation in Canadian politics. But they had they could set up a subsidiary in the United States, and then under NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, they would have access to this this dispute settlement mechanism that's really the legal system or the enforcement system under these trade agreements. And under the North American Free Trade Agreement, under NAFTA, the American representation of that company could file a complaint against the Quebec provincial against Canada, mm-hmm. and then Canada would have influence over Quebec. So what this says is that the Canadian company has rights beyond what they would have as a Canadian company mm-hmm. to intervene in this global dispute settlement mechanism to promote their interests above the public health, something that a Canadian company doesn't have, but a foreign company would have in Canada. Hmm. So the United States would be subject to similar complaints by foreign companies. So foreign companies have greater rights than our own domestic companies would have under our domestic law to promote their interests over public health. So in America, we think it's natural to balance public interests, clean water, clean air, health consequences of fracking. Those are public interests. We think it's quite natural that that's the function of government. That's exactly what government is supposed to do, balance those public interests against the private interest of the oil companies. Mm-hmm. The trade agreements say, well, we will, you can do what you want. You can do whatever you want in your domestic legal system. But in this global system, we have our own priorities. And in the global system, the priorities are that the oil company has the highest interest. And anything that interferes with their interest in trade, which is to say drilling oil and selling it, that private interest in trade is paramount. And you can do whatever you want to regulate as long as it doesn't interfere with that paramount interest in trade. So the public interest is automatically set at a lower priority. And the global dispute settlement process is its own legal process. And it makes decisions based on the values and principles that are expressed in the trade agreement, not the values and principles that are expressed in Canadian politics or law, and not the values and principles that are expressed in American law. So the trade agreements now become the new legal standard that the dispute settlement system will look to. And the standard is very simple: private interest over public interest.
Well, that is seriously alarming.
It's shocking, yeah.
It's just unbelievable. I mean, it's basically like all of the rights that we've been accustomed to, all of the various debates to get the right balance of health and safety versus economic interests go out the door, because at this point there's a global superstructure that has the ultimate authority and prevails. You know, I just have to ask, and I know it's not your area of expertise, but perhaps you, coming from your interesting position, have encountered this. You know, on the one hand, and I know it's not our main topic, but I can't help thinking about this. On the one hand, we have a debate going on where there are some in our political life where, you know, there are some sectors in society, some groups and populations that are saying, get government out of the way. You know, we want our freedom, we want our liberty to make our decisions without this interference. And yet, you know, and so if one tries to regulate a toxic chemical that may be impacting the health of newborns and babies and creating lifelong health problems, kind of thing that I report on, you know, the argument will be, let government stand aside. You know, we don't want to interfere. But here, you know, and it's like everyone, you know, every business, everybody should have the, you know, the freedom of making their own decision. But here you have like this superstructure coming in if this is passed, which will basically be bigger and more powerful than any government. You know, I wonder how the populations that hold that other view, you know, are they thinking, wow, this is great, this is what we've always wanted? Because it would seem that it would, I can see where it would serve, you know, certain industries, but what about all the people that would be affected by this global shift in authority to, you know, what has been the response to that?
You know, I had a conversation like this with one of our congressmen. It was a fascinating question, actually, and I had never thought of it this way. And he said, you know, here we are in the 21st century America, and I say we think it's quite natural that the government should promote this balance between public and private interests. And he said, you know, that took us 200 years in America to sort that out. Mm-hmm. And right? I hadn't really thought of it that way. But, you know, I look back at that, and in the New Deal, the Supreme Court, around the time of the Depression and the New Deal, the Supreme Court said, well, you know, these things that President Roosevelt wants to do, those are an interference with the free market. And, you know, it's kind of a clash between free market capitalism and, you know, government regulation. And there was a lot of back and forth in that, and the Supreme Court said that a lot of the things Franklin Roosevelt wanted to do were unconstitutional. And then the Supreme Court, you know, again, I think responding to public pressure and the response of people, common sense, the mm-hmm. Supreme Court shifted back and said, okay, there's this police power, as lawyers say, that government always has, and that gives the government authority to regulate. And there are a lot of you know, legal scholars and conservative thinkers never really accepted that defeat, and mm-hmm. they've always wanted to increase their power and you know, the privilege they have not to be regulated, and certainly we see that in the, you know, Tea Party and right wing dialogue now.
Mm-hmm.
These trade agreements give those interests the chance to take another shot at. And here's a clean slate where they get to write or they get to participate in how these trade agreements are going to be written. What is the language that goes into the trade agreements? And I actually read an article by William Grider, the journalist from 2001, where he interviewed one of the negotiators for NAFTA, which set this model. NAFTA was the first mm-hmm. trade agreement that set this model. And that particular negotiator said that's exactly what he had in mind, and he mm-hmm. helped write that language. And this was the chance to reestablish that that business interest of being free from regulation. And globalization, when you think about it, is an opportunity for industry and investors to say, well, look, I can now scour the earth for any country with a weak civil society or a weak regulatory tradition and invest in new industrial capacity or economic activity in that country, and these mm-hmm. trade agreements will protect me from regulation and give me bargaining power against any country that has strong regulation, that mm-hmm. look, I can just move my factory to this other country if mm-hmm. you make too much trouble for me. And mm-hmm. the trade agreements also give the investors and industry the opportunity to threaten any country or state that says, I'm thinking of this regulation, and the business interests could say, well, that's great, but I'm going to take you to the WTO, and it's going to cost you millions of dollars, and I'm probably going to win, and you're subject to trade sanctions. if I do win, so I think it's not a good idea. So the intimidation factor is there too. So this really does shift power. The global trade agreements and the provisions in the global trade agreements and the threat of sanctions in the trade agreements give the investors and business a huge increase in bargaining power relative to this question of regulation. Is regulation a legitimate way to balance public interest and private interest?
Wow, that is scary, scary stuff for, you know, anyone who cares about the kinds of things that we cover on this program. Let me ask a question just so that, people can get a sense of where we are in the process right now. And then we can get back to, you know, sort of drilling down into further details of this. And I think you've just done a terrific job of sketching out the whole problem. And we'll get down to sort of more concrete examples next, but before we go there, let me just ask where we are in the process now. In other words, I don't want my listeners to feel like, oh, it's too late, I can't intervene, when in fact now would be the time. Can you frame that for us, please?
Right. So this process, I think this process is starting with NAFTA, and we had sort of political debate around NAFTA, which was kind of confusing. I certainly didn't understand it at the time. Since then, we've had dozens of bilateral trade agreements. They're called an agreement between the United States and Peru, between the United States and Jordan. And, nationally, there are hundreds of these. So certainly the trend is well established, and the consequences of this are pretty clear, in terms of the history of these agreements. This particular agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, involves about a dozen countries around the Pacific Rim. So we're thinking of Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, Malaysia, and then in South America. And now the Canada and Mexico have joined, and we're talking with Japan. So this, this would be approximately 40% of the economic activity of the world. And then we didn't mention this, but there's another one going on, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership that would be between Europe and the United States, and basically the same general idea. In terms of legislative process, the negotiations have been going on for years, and they're fairly well developed, but no final language yet, and many obstacles to a final language remain. The expectation was, well, in a couple of weeks, in a couple of months, So arguably it's within a couple of months of being finished, but, provisionally signed, tentatively signed, and then each country has to approve it. But, completion date keeps pushing out into the future. Legislatively, what would happen is this would go to Congress, and you would think of it as a treaty, which is, and there are provisions in the Constitution for a treaty. This is not a treaty. This is some kind of executive something or other. There's a legal fiction that they have for this, so that it would require not a two-thirds vote for a treaty, but a simple majority vote when it gets to Congress. The way we've done this in the past, just looking at the logistics of Congress, even a simple majority vote would be very difficult. It'd be a heavy lift, as they say, especially in this Congress. So the practice has been to have something called Trade Promotion Authority, TPA, or commonly known as Fast Track. And Fast Track is a separate piece of legislation that says Congress will grant additional authority to the president to negotiate this deal. The Trade Promotion Authority legislation says we want the president to include this provision and that provision and this other provision. The Trade Promotion Authority could say we must have these, or it could say we would like to have these conditions. It depends on what the language, actually is for the Trade Promotion Authority. The president then either does or doesn't follow that direction. And by the president, I mean the U.S. Trade Representative who actually negotiates the deal. And then when it goes
what
to Congress...
What is the status of Fast Track right now?
There's two bills, one in the House and one in the Senate. that are not very good. They're weak, and they say, "Boy, we would like to have this, but if you don't do this, then you know, we'll clench our teeth and go forward." Mm-hmm. Neither of those bills is going anywhere. They could. I think they got one Democrat in the Senate. Senator Baucus was the only one to co-sponsor that trade promotion authority bill, and he's retiring and going to, I think he's going to be ambassador to Japan or China. Mm-hmm. No Democrats would co-sponsor it in the House, and both of those bills are essentially dead. But what
that's good work. Partially citizen activism, was it not?
Of course.
Or is it just that people recognized the problem?
Oh, you know, that's an interesting question. It's all about politics. It's all about power, right? Mm-hmm. And the beauty of this, if I were to say, is that Terry Reid, bless his heart, the Senate Majority Leader, is looking to the elections in 2014, a political calculation. And the Democrats' message is going to be inequality is the defining problem of our time. And mm-hmm. Harry Reid is perceptive enough to say the Democrats cannot say, make the political campaign about inequality is the defining problem of our time. And at the same time say, we're going to pass mm-hmm. these trade agreements, right? Which everybody understands. Are deindustrializing the United States and a threat to democracy and a threat to the ability to regulate the public good. This is simply mm-hmm. a political impossibility. So he said there's not going to be a vote on trade promotion authority in the Senate, period. Mm-hmm. So good for him. And that was, as you said, that's a response to the political realization. You know, the way I say this is that in 1993 with NAFTA, there was the presumption that these trade agreements are good, right? Trade is good. We all know trade is good, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. Now public sentiment has shifted, and our lived experience for 20 years is, well, wait, this wasn't a good deal. This didn't help me. This affected me in a negative way. It reduced my feeling of security and my economic prospects and my sense of opportunity and fairness. Now the presumption is that these trade agreements are probably bad. And it's mm-hmm. the burden of proof on people like the U.S. Trade Representative to demonstrate to me that these are good. Well, that's a huge political advantage for us. And politicians are slowly coming to realize that when they come out and talk to people in their districts and they hear objections to the environmental issues and the human rights issues and the labor rights issues, the public health issues, mm-hmm. the financial regulation, all these things that we think are serious mm-hmm. issues politically, that we would now be put at a disadvantage in terms of the public interest by these trade agreements. You know, why mm-hmm. is that a good thing?
Mm-hmm. Let's take a break here, Sam, because in the second half of the show, I'd like to get into some of these specifics. You just put together a fantastic mm-hmm. kind of list for us. From what you're saying, it is recognized that it isn't a good deal. I mean, some folks in the political life are recognizing it isn't a good deal. So that is hopeful.
Yes.
So that's a good thing. Let's just finish this first half of the show, because then we'll go into our station identification break, with a little, update in terms of what people could do right now to intervene in this process, and we'll talk more about that in the second part of the show, too. But I want to leave our first half of the show listeners with something they can do during the break. One of the things that do you have anything special in terms of where they could go to intervene? Because I see that the Sierra Club has an activist toolkit that people can go to. So if you Google Sierra Club plus TPP activist toolkit, listeners, you can take action there. Any other favored organizations or places where people can get involved, Stan, before we take our break, and then we'll come back?
Sure. 350.org and Move On. Just about any institution of civil society that we think of as, activism are starting to understand this affects them, you know, as you said in your introduction. You can... going to town hall meetings. This is the election season, right?
Mm-hmm.
So going to town hall meetings and communicating with your elected officials. This is really the focal point, I think, for the next several months.
And that sounds terrific. And I think there will be places to go and tools for doing just that. So stay with us, listeners. We're going to take our PRN station break. We'll be back with you in a couple of minutes with Stan Sorcher talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Please stay with us for the second half of the show. We'll be delving in a little bit in depth about how some of the issues we all care about will be affected were this to pass. Okay. Welcome back to the second half of Connect the Dots. Again, it's Allison Rose Levy, and we're talking today about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, with Stan Sorcher. If you missed the first half of the show, you can find it later this afternoon in the Connect the Dots archive. Or if you are enjoying this program, please do like us on iTunes as well as pass us along to friends and other people who might be interested. You can follow our guest today, Stan Sorcher, as well as me, Allison Rose Levy, on the Huffington Post, to stay in touch with all the new developments. Stan covers those regularly on Huffington. I write about health, food, and the environment across a range of vectors. So you can stay up to date by following us and getting our blogs. They'll send you a little email, and you can get our blogs and upcoming articles. Very important for the TPP because, as we learned in the first half of the show, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is functioning if it passes, which we are endeavoring to make sure it does not. It really functions as a superstructure, a global superstructure that supersedes local law, as Stan has been telling us. So let's get back to that conversation, perhaps with a few more examples of ways in which that could happen and what that would look like, so we kind of get out of the superstructure Uber level that we've kind of sketched and been talking about in the first half of the show. And if you've missed that, you can go back to that in the archives and talk about like what this would look like for a range of issues about which we are all concerned. As Stan said in the first half of the show, it has been up to national and local governments to look into getting the right balance between business interests and health and safety concerns of citizens. As we know from a variety of the issues I cover, that conversation has been a little tipped by things like lobbyists, influence of all kinds, campaign financing in secret of elected officials, revolving door regulators. We'd all like to see public health and safety better favored than the current balance. But if it comes in, the TPP will actually tip it way, way far in the other direction to a point where it's going to be very difficult for local citizens in any country to have a voice. So let's go back to our conversation with Stan Sorcher and explore some of the ways that this could play out. Welcome back to the second half of the show, Stan.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, so could you give a few examples? I'm sure that from the others who are involved in this struggle, you know, you've heard those kinds of concerns. Could you share with our listeners some sort of concrete in-community or issue-by-issue ways that the TPP could have an adverse effect?
Sure. So when I talk to people about this, there's the first reaction is, well, they wouldn't really do that, right? I mean, you've described this shift in power, but nobody would really do that, right? It's like, and what is that really doing? It's expressing our sense of proportion, right? Our sense of confidence in our democracy and our political process, our sense of stability. So I think that's very powerful. As long as we can hang on to that and say, we're really sure this is the way we want our society to work, that's a strength. So that's a social pressure that prevents somebody who has extraordinary power from exercising it. So, for instance, when NAFTA first passed, UPS jumped up and said, "Well, I think the postal system is a barrier to trade. Right? If Canada has a postal system, that interferes with UPS's ability to the trade, in its case, a service of Wolverine packages. And there was an uproar about that, just ridiculous, and UPS backed down. And there's some examples of that. There's some simple ones. There are four simple examples that I think can that have gone through the process. These were complaints against policies the United States had, and we lost all four. So this is a sense of, you know, what level of nerve, you know, investors have to enforce their rights. So one of them I think we're familiar with is tuna fish labeling, that we had little happy dolphins on our cans of tuna fish, and this represented an effort by companies selling tuna fish to protect dolphins. And we had the Marine Mammal Protection Act, I think it was the Marine Mammal Act, Marine Mammal Protection Act, that said that tuna fish in the United States could only be sold if the fishing practices protected dolphins. And that was one kind of label. And I think Mexico or Thailand, who had a fishing industry, filed a complaint and said, well, that's an unfair restraint of trade. Tuna fish is tuna fish, a cookie is a cookie, dog food is dog food. There's no legitimate reason for distinguishing, differentiating one kind of tuna fish from another kind of tuna fish. And we lost that. Mm-hmm. So there were sanctions applied, and if we didn't change the way we allowed tuna fish to come into the United States, there would be enormous sanctions, and we'd back down and said, okay, we'll set up a voluntary system for tuna fish. Mm-hmm. And anybody who voluntarily protects dolphins and put a different label on the tuna fish, and, you know, anybody in the world can do that. Again, another complaint, and that no, this is the only, under the trade agreement, the language, the test under the trade agreement is that the regulation has to be the least trade restrictive. Hmm. So, you know, there might be some other way you could protect dolphins that's less trade restrictive than this, and you pick one that's too trade restrictive, more trade restrictive than necessary. And again, we lost. And we backed down, and that's pretty much it for tuna fish labeling.
Wow, so that's amazing. Let me just comment on that for a second, because
sure.
You know, that has just tremendous implications. My mind is reeling hearing this across the board. As many of my listeners here are aware, you know, we've been talking about labeling with both GMO ingredients
exactly.
in food, as well as food additives. There's been, you know, whether high fructose corn syrup is considered, you know, just like sugar, whether GMOs are substantially equivalent to regular traditional seeds. You know, so the whole question of, you know, on the one hand, I think one of the things that keeps people away from activism is that, you know, there's a sense, well, my consumer power will do it all. But if
right.
you, there's no point in having consumer power unless you have consumer information. And what you're describing with this dolphin label, and it's the same thing that applies across the board to the other issues that I've mentioned, is the wish to not have not allow the public to have that information.
Exactly.
And if we lose those battles and we don't have that information, then we don't really, A, have consumer, you know, we don't have the information we need to make a consumer choice. And instead, you know, we are consuming, our children are consuming, we're both consuming things that may be actively harmful, but we're also participating in practices, whether it's how animals are treated or in the case of, you know, how tuna is harvested, or even which, you know, which animal is in something, we have no say in the ethics, and so we're being swept along in, you know, whatever companies regard as expedient, if that you know, that right to information and to label is taken away. And that's what you're describing.
Sure. There's another one. I don't want to alarm you, but it's called country of origin labeling.
Mm-hmm.
And again, just as you've said, as a consumer, I might be interested in knowing whether my meat products come from Canada, which maybe I would have a positive impression of, or does it come from China? And I might, as a consumer, might make a purchasing decision on that. So mm-hmm. we had country of origin labeling as an expression of that consumer interest. We went through our political process, and we said, well, we're going to, and that's true of manufactured goods, right? Manufactured goods say made in China, made in Thailand, made in Honduras. Mm-hmm. Same thing for food products. Mm-hmm. And I forget which country, but this was a big fight, and a company in a country that had one of these trade agreements with the United States said, well, wait, if you make me label my food products, this is going to affect my future profit. And again, I didn't make this clear yet, but the test that the trade tribunals use is, was this the least trade restrictive regulation possible? And the company suing can sue for loss of future profit. And
amazing.
You can't do this. Yeah, you can't do this in our domestic legal system. You can't do it in Canada's domestic legal system. But the penalty, the remedy, the harm and the remedy is based on future profits. So the meat producing companies complained about the country of origin labeling, saying this is going to affect our trade and affect our profits, and that's a harm, a takings. I don't know, we hear this in the Tea Party language, right? It's a takings. The regulation took my future profits, I want to be compensated for it. And, the legal thinking here, the legal philosophy is, you took my future profits, you can do that. I mean, if that's what you want to do as your regulation, you can do that. You just mm-hmm. have to pay me, compensate me for the loss of future profits. And mm-hmm. the country of origin labeling thing went through the tribunal process, which is not a legal process. These aren't judges. It isn't accountable the way we think of our judicial process. There's just mm-hmm. a bunch of trade lawyers who mm-hmm. get together and apply the principles of the trade agreement, mm-hmm. honoring the priorities and rights and privileges of the investors to their future profits mm-hmm. above our interest in, as you've expressed very well, as consumers, right? So we lost the country of origin labeling complaint. Mm-hmm. And we can no longer, if we have country of origin labeling, we have to compensate any foreign meat producers for their loss of future profit.
That's simply astounding. And I want to just comment, I can't help really but comment here, that we don't have any loss of future health provision or loss of future food supply provision.
Right.
Or loss of future period, right. water. And these are all life fundamentals. They are
okay.
not protected. They don't have the comparable protection.
Right.
In fact, many people in the environmental movement would like to see the rights of the public commons, the rights of future generations protected. But we don't have that now. But if these trade agreements came in, then the profits of foreign companies would be protected, where the rights of our children and grandchildren to the prerequisites for life in a purified and harm-free state are not protected.
Exactly.
This is an egregious imbalance, and it's one that really cannot be allowed to go forward.
It's interesting you say that. Joseph Stiglitz was in town in Seattle. I live in Seattle. He was here talking about his book about globalization. He brought up exactly that point that if we think it's important in our political process, our political history, that we do, our courts do balance public interest and private interest, and that's part of our legal system. And mm-hmm. and so the question to him was, how would you do that in a global environment? Mm-hmm. And his point of view was, and remember, he was the chief economist at the World Bank, and so he understands global financial institutions, the WTO, mm-hmm. the World Bank, and the IMF. These are global institutions that were set up to protect the interests of investors. That's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
He imagined corresponding global institutions that protect public interest, so the environment and labor rights and public health.
Mm-hmm.
And he met some kind of global institution with enforcement powers comparable to what the investors have. And that was one way that he imagined, you know, just as you expressed it, right? Where's my interest? Where's the institution that represents my public interest? And what's mm-hmm. the enforcement mechanism that my public interest would have in mm-hmm. balance with the investor interest?
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. That's what's needed. And, you know, that seems like a clear gap in, you know, in what we're talking about. It's like not really a level playing field, or anywhere near a level playing field without that. So yeah, that's really incredible. We're coming down to the last 8 or 9 minutes or so of the program. Mm-hmm. Are there, you know, so we Stop TPP is one place that people can go to online in order to participate and be informed of actions going forward and ways that they can, you know, kind of participate. Is MoveOn.org, you've mentioned. I mentioned Sierra Club. These are all organizations. So, you know, mm-hmm. anyone listening to this can see that these are very mainstream groups, you know, on the progressive and environmental side of things, you know, that really, you know, this is not a fringe concern. This is like a major overarching thing. I think the other thing, obviously, that we need to be concerned about is the elections, because as you delineated, you know, right now the makeup of Congress and the Senate are such that this would not be, you know, kind of going forward under the current Congress. But, of course, we're coming up to elections, and that's another place that we could be vulnerable, and that's mm-hmm. also the place that we should get involved. Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, how people can get involved?
There's another organization, Public Citizen, has mm-hmm. a branch called Global Trade Watch, and they also have a lot of information and help organize a lot of these activities.
Mm-hmm.
I actually do go to town hall meetings that elected officials have,
mm-hmm.
and I'm often surprised. It's kind of fun to see how many people are aware of the consequences of these trade agreements and mm-hmm. and bring it up and confront their elected official on these issues. You know, there's a dynamic that happens in Washington, D.C., which I'm becoming more familiar with. there are partial steps that you don't have to defeat a piece of legislation. Mm-hmm. They're called sign-on letters or dear colleague letters, and you know, hundreds of congressmen and senators will sign on to a letter that mm-hmm. says, you know, we jointly, however many 230 senators members of Congress, you know, will sign on to a letter.
Mm-hmm.
We want to see labor rights, strong labor protections in trade agreements. We want to see strong environmental protections mm-hmm. in trade agreements. Another one we haven't talked about is very important, is currency manipulation. It's kind of a technical thing, but it translates into billions of dollars. Currency manipulation is bad and should not be allowed under the trade agreement. So encouraging your elected official, and you'll see these on the Global Trade Watch and Sierra Club, they'll talk about these letters. And mm-hmm. there's one actually going around right now. We want you to sign on to this letter that demands these conditions be in the trade agreement. If your member of Congress has already signed the letter, you thank them.
mm-hmm.
You know, hey, I see that you signed on to this trade agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, this is so easy. It seems like such an emotional barrier to call your elected official.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever go to an office, you see the receptionist has a little tally sheet, and they take calls all day long, and they just put in a little, you know, jot mark down when somebody calls for or against a certain piece of legislation. If you get 8 or 9 calls, that's a big deal. And you call the office and say, I understand, you know, Congressman so-and-so has signed on to this letter. I want to thank him. This is very important to me. I'm a constituent. You know, thank you very much. Goodbye. It's like a 10-second phone call. The receptionist marked it down. If you have 5 or 8 or 12 calls on that This is a big deal, and it gets to the attention of the elected official. If you go to, you know, a campaign meeting or a fundraiser or wherever you run into these people and say something, you know, all day long they get lobbyists coming into their office and telling them to vote for these trade agreements. If that's the only human interaction that they have, that will stick in their mind. If they have a human interaction with constituents that expresses our public interest, that sticks in their mind. So we think of this as maybe not worth the effort. It is worth the effort.
Yeah, that's really, I think that's an excellent, excellent point because, you know, we kind of declare the game over before we've even begun, you know, and I saw this with fracking too. When I first began, you know, I'm one of the, really pretty much the second reporter after Abram Lisgardner and ProPublica who was covering this issue, and everybody kind of thought I was nuts and I'd gone off the deep end or something. Suddenly they didn't realize, you know, the far-reaching impacts. And, you know, I've covered it to this day, and quite frankly, there's always something new that we're finding out about it.
Right.
It's very, you know, complex, far-reaching problem. And, of course, public awareness, I'm happy and proud to say, and I'm certainly not the sole person responsible, but part of a team of people, you know, has really been raised extraordinarily due to this. And, you know, and yet, and this is the international gas and oil companies, you know, among the most wealthy in the world, the most powerful in the world. And yet, you know, we don't know that we've completely, in many places it's happening. In other places we've held it back. But any and all attempts by citizens to stop or stall or intervene in these things can indeed work. I've seen that myself. And you know, the other thing, too, is don't knock it till you've tried it. Don't, you know, kind of knock yourself out of it and say it doesn't help until you've done it for a while. And, you know, if you would save for your children's college education, if you want to give them a good start in life, whatever, or, you know, and many people still care whether or not they have or don't have children. You know, these are things that you do to kind of assure well-being for those who come after.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we do all of those good things and we provide for the material things, but we don't provide a healthy society with democratic freedoms, we don't provide the life resources that we need and that they will need, then we're not really planning for their future. So that's me and my hobby horse. So you've heard many ways today to get involved and let your voice be heard on the TPP. I want to thank you so much, Stan Sorcher, for being with us on this. And I know you're going to continue, to remain active and to blog. Please take action in the way listeners that Stan has described. Follow him on the Huffington Post because he'll be writing on various permutations of this as well as updating. You can follow the organizations we've mentioned, Stop TPP, TPP Watch, MoveOn.org, the Sierra Club. Progressive Democrats of America also has a vibrant TPP Watch program. You know, and do get involved. Get involved in the process. Don't consider it something that's unimportant. Move it up nearer to a prominent place on your to-do list. And whatever issue, listeners, you're involved with, or even if you haven't been involved in any issue, this is a good one to begin with, I would say. Would you, Stan?
Oh, sure. The political process for this is intended to be complex and opaque. And the way you talk about it, you know, connecting the dots to how this affects us in our daily lives is the antidote to that. So as we see how this is important and how it affects our lives, it becomes part of the public conversation, and that becomes a political offset that counterbalances the message from the investors and business community.
That's an important point, too. In other words, also talk to other people about this. You know, what you've learned today, read more about it, learn more about it, talk to others about it, pass the show along to other people, pass blogs that you read of Stan's along to other people, you know, kind of spread the information field because, as Stan is saying, you know, this is has been designed to try to be secret, so it's also part of our job, and every one of us can participate in making it better known. So thank you so much, Stan Sorcher, for being with me today on Connect the Dots.
It's good talking to you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, listeners, too. We'll be back again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern on Connect the Dots with another guest talking about the TPP. Not to be missed, we're going to have Margaret Flowers on. And also, this coming Sunday, Memorial Day Sunday weekend at 9 p.m., I'm going to be hosting, as a substitute, the Lifeboat Hour. And we'll also be talking about the TPP on that program. So please tune in, and thank you for being with us. Come back next week. I'm Allison Rose Levy.